Everyone, welcome back to the show. So I'm very excited for this, and in true BoJack fashion, I imagine I'll be very depressed by the end. But for now, we'll see how long we can make that last. We're here today to talk about one of my favorite shows, and a show that's a favorite for a lot of people out there, BoJack Horseman. And to do that, I have a Mike Bloom type and some lady better known as Liana Boris. How are you both doing?
Damn it, that was going to be my intro joke. How dare
what
you?
What is this, a crossover podcast?
This is the least ambitious crossover event in history, but this is the best I can manage for today. So I think the best place to start, as always, is how you both heard about the show, because I know for my part, I heard about the show through Mike, and initially I was very skeptical, and it was seeing Mike post about it.
As you should be when I recommend things, yes.
Mike is like Mr. Peanut Butter. He is so enthusiastic about everything that you can't tell if it's actually any good or not.
Well, so I guess I got into the show when it was right before the second season actually dropped. And I am a huge Will Arnett fan. So I was like, yeah, I'll check this out. I had actually heard very little about BoJack Horseman. I think it was something that just popped up on my Netflix queue. I was like, oh, I like Will Arnett. This looks kind of funny. And then, you know, once obviously I looked at the cast, I was like, oh, Alison Brie, Amy Sedaris, Aaron Paul, Paul F. Tompkins. Like, oh, I'm so down. And, you know, the first episode happens. I was like, okay, this is pretty good. Watch the second episode. And then, of course, what hooked me was Neil McBeal, the Navy SEAL, and the fact that it was voiced by Patton Oswalt just totally solidified me. So I kept watching the season. And then slowly as the season goes along, because I didn't know anything about it, I was like, this is getting kind of dark. this is not really where I thought this would go. Like the fun animated show about the cartoon horse. but I was at kind of a dark place in my life. And so it really started to connect with me. And after that first season, I was just hooked and could not wait for the second one to drop.
Yeah, so my origin story is very similar to Liana's. I guess I was sort of like a day one fan, as weird as that is to say, with Netflix shows, just because I had heard about the cast beforehand. And yeah, huge Arrested Development fan, so I saw Will Arnett's name on there. A huge Community fan, so I saw Alison Brie. Love Strangers with Candy, Amy Sedaris. Aaron Paul was probably the biggest question mark there, because, you know, this was only a couple years, actually only a year or so after Breaking Bad had finished, and he was like a three-time dramatic Emmy Award winner, so I was a little unsure about it, but Paul F. Tompkins is like one of my comedic idols. He is so giddy, so goofy, so ready to do anything that, you know, I always try to work like him. So when I saw that cast, I'm like, okay, let me check this out. And the fact that it was also like initially modeled off of, hey, here's this guy, what if a guy from a Full House like show became a washed up actor, you know, several years later, and we checked in with him. So as someone who unabashedly watched Full House reruns on the reg every single afternoon when I was growing up, this really hit close to home. The first half of season one is probably the weakest part of the show overall. So if we're sort of using this to kind of parlay any sort of recommendations to, you know, a new or prospective BoJack fans out there, I would say that like the first five or six episodes or so are good. They're still fun. There are still plot elements that get incorporated through the rest of the canon throughout the series. But to Liana's point, the emotional weight of the show, which I feel like is really something that drives a lot of people's motivations and, you know, love for the show, doesn't really come into effect until around that second half of the season. And yeah, I'm not somebody who, even growing up, I pretty much only watched comedies. Like I only started watching dramas essentially with Lost, which happened, you know, when I was like 15 or so. And so it was weird for me to sort of just see the hard left turn, or maybe I guess a slight turn that the show took, because it still goes back sometimes to the well of insane pun-filled comedy and zaniness. But there's so much heft to it, and the elements that it deals with, depression, basically anxiety and depression, and basically around that, all the feelings and relationships that are constructed around those types of feelings. It has a lot of weight to it, but it's something that depresses me significantly sometimes. But then the next episode, they'll throw in some sort of stupid pun where, you know, Scott Wolf is a fox and Matthew Fox is a wolf that, like, picks me right back up again, like some sort of weird drug also named BoJack. So it definitely brought me in with the cast, and then I stayed because of the actual material that was being presented, especially in the latter half of the first season.
And as you said, you have some doubts about Aaron Paul, but if he is the person you have the most questions about in a given cast, that's already a pretty good sign. You know, that is a complaint you're happy to have. And yet, as you said, the first few episodes fell very flat for a lot of critics. So you go back to the TV overview in 2014, 2015 on places like the AV Club and elsewhere. And BoJack Horseman barely registers. And when it does, it's always with some mild praise, but they're unsure why it exists or if it should even come back for a second season. And one theory that I've heard to explain that is the critics initially only received as screeners the first 5 or 6 episodes of the show, and it's after that point almost exactly where the show takes its turn and starts to come into its own and explore these deeper themes. So do you think there is a point there where the show does pivot and there is a noticeable shift between what came before and what came after?
I would say that I'm looking at the season one episode list now, and I would say maybe it's between like 2 episodes. I would say episode 5, which is Live Fast, Die Nguyen, is a good one where, you know, this entire plot so far was, okay, we have this character Diane, played by Alison Brie, who's ghostwriting this memoir for BoJack Horseman, but this is where we go to see Diane's family, and I think we start to sort of see her underlying issues, because up to this point, the show was pretty much all about BoJack, and I think the strongest thing about this show is the fact that, as we talked about, it's such a strong cast. It might be one of the strongest ensembles of a show on today. And the fact that the show is now starting to actually rely on those other characters instead of making it the BoJack Horseman show, even though his name's in the title, I think really is the show's greatest strength. And this is where we sort of find out a little bit about this. This is also where we get into Todd's zany schemes. They invite people over to BoJack's house thinking he's David Boreanaz. And then that leads to Todd getting arrested. And that's followed very quickly by the next episode, which is called Our A Story is a D Story. And I love this episode because, you know, there's the silliness that happens with BoJack, but one of the things I love about it is its continuity. We just talked about this on The Simpsons, Dom, that sometimes a lot of the time these animated shows do not necessarily, continue things along. They'll oftentimes reset to get things back to status quo. So if you flip on the television at any point, you can catch any episode without the need to worry about, okay, what did I miss? What was the episode before this? But this is the episode where BoJack steals the D from the Hollywood sign for Diane, and it ends up getting destroyed. So throughout the rest of the series, they call the place Hollywoo. And it just, everyone completely adapts to it. It's sprinkled in through every single mention up through the 4th season. So I think one of the reasons why I hold that episode close to my heart, maybe it's more of a symbolic shift than anything, is the fact that this is a show that's not going to be your average cartoon. It's going to commit to sort of these, Leon, I think you made a great comparison with Arrested Development. There are a lot of these longer running gags. I mean, season 3, they keep literally lampshading like, oh, these spaghetti strainers, they're going to be important at some point. And it turns out that they are at the very end, which, again, the narrative of the show between the comedy and the drama is something that I absolutely love about it.
Well, so it's interesting because I sort of want to merge those two ideas, Mike, that you sort of talked about this longstanding narrative and then also going back to the criticism of the beginning episodes of the show, because I think that, like, I understand that they got a lot of criticism, but I think if those episodes hadn't have been structured the way that they were, I don't think I would have really gotten, I really wouldn't have fully understood the whole season, because you sort of have to have these like weird kind of goofy, you know, very jokeful episodes to then sort of build up to a lot of the seriousness, which we're talking about, you know, sort of when that shift occurs, which, you know, I think definitely certainly by the telescope episode, which is where BoJack goes to mend fences with Herb, the original creator of Horsin' Around. I think that that's when definitely it gets very serious. But I think if I hadn't been introduced to the characters in sort of a very lighthearted way, I don't know if I necessarily then would have been able to accept all of the very seriousness, because BoJack as a show really does somehow balance this, like you said, Mike, these weird, silly, you know, sight gags in the background. Like, for example, when Diane is going to get an abortion, Mr. Peanut Butter is holding a balloon that says it's a boy, but boy is crossed out. And he wrote boarded. It's aborted. Look, it's that level of seriousness mixed with just this weird goofiness. And I think that that first season really sets up this narrative of sort of crafting that through the beginning sort of silliness and then getting into the seriousness that then continues throughout the rest of the seasons.
Yeah, I think if you aim to weave those two seemingly opposed elements together in a cohesive mm-hmm. way, it's going to take some time to establish that balance, and you need to take the time and put the work in to establish both of those elements individually before you're able to combine them together. And going back to points that both of you made, if you look at the focus of the early episodes, there's no real theme that you can identify. So immediately out of the gates, you have BoJack Hates the Troops, which is one of my favorite episodes to this day and really stands alone as a great piece of TV. And I know that a lot of the people who got into BoJack did it because they found that clip of BoJack going off on Neil McBeal on YouTube, or they heard about it and that drove them into the show. But then you watch the other episodes and they are completely different in tone and in content. And you wonder whether it's the same show that you're actually watching. And then as you get into the middle part of the first season, you take this time to focus on individual characters. So you have an episode for Todd, an episode for Diane, an episode for Mr. Peanut Butter, an episode for Princess Carolyn, and necessarily that will involve other characters being shifted to the sidelines for some portion of that. So if you're drawn in because you find BoJack an entertaining character, and then this episode he is just off doing his own thing somewhere and the focus is on Todd, maybe that puts you off. So it's hard to, in those initial group of episodes, find something that's there for everybody. And that's why I think there is this mixed reception. But when you look at the data that's come out, so Netflix keeps this data on when do viewers typically get hooked in by a show? After what point, when they start, do they commit and keep watching? And they identified episode 5, so Diane goes back to Boston and we meet her family, as that hook. And then if you look at the IMDb ratings for the first season, they really start to pick up around episode 7, which is Princess Carolyn's episode. And then by the time you get to the telescope, I think most people are convinced if they make it that far.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, I think what we were talking about with episode 5, Live Fast, Diane Nguyen, which is a fantastic title in and of itself. The fact that you really start to learn about Diane and you sort of have this seriousness about her relationship with her family. And then at the same time, her father gets chummed and they want, because the family wants to throw it in Derek Jeter's face, right? I mean, I think this is just another example of, like, if you sort of are a fan of this weird mixture of seriousness, but also just complete bizarre situational comedy, you know, this sort of feels like a really good example of that. So it kind of makes sense that that's, you know, really the episode where people start to get hooked.
Can we talk for a second about we can talk about the general construct of BoJack Horseman, but I feel like we definitely need to talk about, I mean, the literal elephant in the room, which is the fact that this is a world that does have some humans in it, but it's mostly populated by, you know, anthropomorphic animals that can walk and talk most of the time. There was an episode in season 2 about, you know, Todd helping break out a chicken who talked in clucks, which is, again, just brings up strange ideas about this world. But the thing that I one of the many things I love about the show is just how creative they can get with that, and whether and what those what those species mean for the relationships between them. I mean, Princess Carolyn has this entire relationship throughout the end of season three and beginning of season 4 with a mouse. And there's a little bit of play between that of, like, oh, they're opposites, but they're attracting. But then she visits her family who, like, have a history of, you know, celebrating a holiday that kills the cats. But it's such a weird idea, again, that you're seeing these emotional beats through all these different types of animals. It seems, I mean, it's literally cartoonish, but I guess it makes it more of a palatable thing, as you were talking, you both were talking about how sometimes they probably set up the show purposely to give you a little bit of time to ease into the characters before presenting with some of the harder themes. Maybe it's okay, let's present this sort of big cartoony world where animals walk the earth, and now we can sort of lay on all the headier issues.
Yeah, well, that episode that you talked about, or, you know, where Princess Carolyn's relationship with whatever the mouse, what was his name?
obviously not Rutabaga is the rabbit.
No, Rutabaga is right. Anyway, not important. But yeah, it's almost a way to sort of set up these dynamics that exist in real life, but doing it from an animal cartoon perspective, right? I mean, it's essentially a family who doesn't approve, right? Or, you know, you have this familial tension between two people who come from very different backgrounds, but it's a mouse and a cat. You know, but it's still something that is very real and something that exists in, you know, in everyday life. So it's interesting that that's a way that they present it to almost give this lighthearted feel to something very serious.
And it's an endless goldmine of these simple jokes that you don't really need to reach any further in order to understand and appreciate. So even when there's no underlying humor in the scene itself, the fact that BoJack is talking to the publisher at Penguin, who happens to be a penguin, like that always is going to add a bit of levity to the scene that just wouldn't be there otherwise. And it's they go back to that well time and time again, and you're happy that they do it. It never really gets old. But it's interesting that over the course of four seasons now, we don't really know anything about the taxonomy of the BoJack Horseman universe, because we don't know if is this like a mythological kind of thing where certain animals are associated with certain personality traits. Is it just some people, I guess, or beings within this universe happen to be animals and no one bats an eyelid at it? Or is there like an established food chain where in the BoJack Horseman society, some animals are more or less respected than others within Hollywood and elsewhere?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because again, that chicken episode brings to light some of the, maybe this is the writer sort of lampshading that idea of, yeah, it doesn't really make sense the more you think about it. But I also like this idea that I guess the animals, much like they do in our world, sort of have their own separate places to rule over. I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk about, you know, a horse out of water, I think is what it's called, or fish out of water, with BoJack going underwater. And that's an entirely different sort of environment that involves completely different creatures. There's an episode in season four where they go underground and they find the ants ruled over by RuPaul, the ant queen. So they do an interesting job sometimes of like actually relying on the animal kingdom we have here proper to sort of divvy things up. I think it's so interesting that they're not all animals, you know, that you do get these human characters like Diane, like Todd, like, you know, Kelsey, like random celebrity, like some celebrities are animals and some are not, like Jessica Biel is Jessica Biel, but then you have these other animals, you know, playing the celebrities themselves. So it's so interesting to sort of, I don't know if the writers purposely pick and choose, if it depends on like the pun or anything, or if there is some sort of significance to it all of which characters are human.
The fact that Vanessa Gecko is a human.
Yes.
Yeah, the fact that they can take it to that next level and reference their own just silly animal gags makes the show that much better. But it's almost impossible at this point, having seen these four seasons, to imagine BoJack as anything but a horse. Like, if BoJack was a human, the show itself would have a completely different feel to it. But I'm not quite sure why it works so well. Like, it's not like horses are intrinsically set or anything other than the obvious long face jokes that the BoJack likes to make. But in some cases it does seem very fitting. So Mr. Peanut Butter works so well as a yellow lab or just that kind of dog, because his personality, that just that endless joy, that goes so well with how we imagine that type of dog to be. Whereas if he was just some other animal chosen at random, maybe it wouldn't click so well.
One of my favorite Mr. Peanut Butter gags is when he opens up the trunk of his car and a bunch of tennis balls like roll out of the car. And he like goes to start chasing them. Oh, it's really great. I just like the idea of these hoarding tennis balls.
I do like those things as well, because like I feel like when the writers can't find things to create about their characters, they just can lean on the facts like, okay, remember, he's a dog. So like come up with jokes about that. So like even in super serious moments, where I'm glad that they gave Paul F. Tompkins a little bit more to do, because he's fantastic as Mr. Peanut Butter, but I'm glad that, for example, they gave more marital strife between Diane and Mr. Peanut Butter to give Paul Tompkins particularly some more stuff to work with. But then he still does stupid dog stuff.
And the fact that it's a different type of humor works so nicely, too, because if it was just rapid fire jokes from pillar to post every single episode, it would be easy for that to get overwhelming or for some of those jokes to just get lost in the shuffle. But the fact that you have these, just this excellent visual humor on top of the carefully crafted traditional joke format, that blend, I think, works so well. And they over the course of especially season two to season four, they learn how to perfect that formula.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, and there are so many, this is what also reminds me of Arrested Development, just so many gags in the background that are never explicitly mentioned that you really sort of have to be paying attention in order to get, which is something I really appreciate about BoJack.
even when you're not really able to pay attention. So I think it's when BoJack first meets Diane and he sees the back of her book. And if you pause and you take a look, there are three or four gags just littered throughout the blurb there. And yet it's on the screen for maybe 2 or 3 seconds. You mm-hmm. literally don't have time to catch those unless you're trying to pay attention. So the fact that they're giving that much care to even the background elements of their own universe is a sight to see.
Yeah, every establishing shot pretty much in BoJack Horseman involves some sort of thing going on with animals. And I can't name any big gags off the top of my head, but I feel like it's either a sign gag a la The Simpsons or there's some sort of brief sequence of events involving the animals. But I mean, to your point, Dom, Tom Jumbo Grumbo, played by Keith Olbermann, you know, whenever he's doing the talking head stuff, there's always stuff going along the bottom third in the little like scrolling text. And I often have to watch those scenes twice because one time I'm listening for him because he does such fantastic, you know, there's a lot of wordplay in this show, and he does a good chunk of them outside of Princess Carola doing that unfortunate Courtney Portnoy stuff all throughout the course of season 4. But then I have to watch it a second time because then I have to read the lower thirds because there's even stuff going on in there as well.
And Keith Olbermann is such perfect casting for that role, and you wonder who would occur to you to think, I know what we need for what's ostensibly a comedy drama show. We need Keith Olbermann, and they actually got him. It seems like they went through that process with every single character member, even the secondary ones. It's like, who would be the actual perfect person if we had our druthers to fill that role? And they were somehow able to get them. So it's not just the main cast, which is star-studded, and whoever your favorite character is on your favorite show on TV has a pretty good chance of appearing in BoJack Horseman at some point. But it's also the extended universe, even these minor roles. You have all these different celebrities willing to come on and play either original characters or these caricatures of themselves. And it's almost like once that ball gets rolling and 2 or 3 people that you know have done cameos in it, you want to be in on the joke. You want to do it too. And so after that initial success, maybe it's no surprise that they were able to get all of these people.
Well, I'm happy that they were. I was looking up some of the crawls, though, from BoJack. So one of them is, police find that mandatory body cams are great for taking selfies.
Oh, God.
Take a job at MSNBC, they said. You can write novels on the weekend, they said. And that's, I mean, yeah, I think the fact that you have such a strong cast, I mean, not only the main cast, but also everybody that has done guest spots. I mean, because they actually get a lot of people to play themselves. And then, I mean, I think I remember the first time I was like, wait, Stephen Colbert is doing guest? Like, it was sort of one of those things that, like you said, Dom, sort of then snowballs where you get more and more people that want to do the show because, you know, oh, it's been done before, you know, by reputable people, which is really enjoyable.
I like to think, and maybe this is my own headcanon, but I like to think that character actress Margot Martindale broke the ceiling on that one, because I think she's the first one to really appear as herself in the 4th episode of season 1. And, I mean, if you want an example of how they just completely, I would almost say in like a very Simpsons or South Park style, take a characterization of a celebrity and completely blow it out to 11. Look at character actress Margot Martindale, who started as like a pretty normal person, and now is turned into like a hardened badass criminal who is now apparently lost at sea and like went insane at one point. It's just, I like to think that, I mean, I know this doesn't air in real time, but like maybe once they got Margot Martindale involved, maybe the word of mouth spread. To your point about Stephen Colbert, I'd have to imagine that Amy Sedaris has some connections there from Strangers with Candy. Because I do, we could talk a little bit, I guess, about the creator of the show. I'm going to probably butcher his name, Raphael Bob Wachsberg. I don't know exactly how much he's able to reach into the community, the Hollywood community, to bring these people on. Since he brought on such a star-studded cast to begin with, maybe he was able to rely on them to sort of use their Rolodexes. But yeah, I mean, they get some real heavy hitters to come on, and especially like, God bless Jessica Biel for being so good with her self-esteem to come on and essentially play this crazy version of herself.
We will note quickly, that's esteemed character actress Margot Martindale to you, Mike. Let's not besmirch her.
Yes, exactly. Sorry, I forgot an adjective there.
But my understanding is this was Raphael Bob Axberg's first major project, and so I don't know if he was able to draw on connections to effortlessly make that happen. But somehow it seemed to work. And you listen to those interviews with him from those first few seasons, he seems as surprised as the audience did. It's like they just idly thought, oh, who would we love to have for this role if we could make it happen? And it wasn't just hypothetical. Somehow it did, and just down the line they got who they wanted.
Okay, hot new fad taking America's youth by storm: the measles. Sorry, I'm still reading the crawl.
No, no, you need to be like the crawl in the actual show and sprinkle these in throughout.
Yeah, right.
let's segue quickly from animals into animation, because it's not just the fact that you have this weird animal universe, which you don't even understand how they came up with. Because with a lot of shows, you understand the premise, it's derivative of themes that you've seen before, and BoJack is to an extent, but you also wonder, what were they on when they came up with this idea? Like, whose twisted joke was it to try and make this show a reality? And yet somehow it works perfectly. But Mike, I know this is something that you wanted to talk about when we did our Simpsons episode, but we never really came around to it, so this might be a good platform for it. But the creator himself gave this quote saying, "In some ways, it's easier to talk about very serious issues through the lens of these wacky cartoon animals. And I think the show business setting kind of gives us that too, because this industry is so over the top and outlandish. It allows us to comment on this real stuff in a way that perhaps if you were more straight ahead, it would feel almost after-school specialish or maudlin or indulgent. And I think there's a lot to that." Mike, what was your take there?
Yes, so I guess speaking towards these larger ideas of the effect of The Simpsons, and I apologize for going back to The Simpsons well, but I just love it so much. But The Simpsons had a profound effect not only on comedy as a medium, but I would say animation. Up to that point, I feel like for the very much most part, cartoons were meant to be slapstick and silly. You know, they weren't really meant to make any sort of commentary or impart any sort of big values or anything. They were something to put on for your kids at 4 o'clock while you know, did other stuff, but The Simpsons sort of broke ground in saying, this is specifically adult animation. These are cartoons that are meant for adults, and sometimes they deal with issues. And The Simpsons didn't really deal with it in such a heavy way as BoJack Horseman, but I really did feel like it started to break ground in saying that, hey, the animated format can be an interesting way to sort of spoon-feed some of these larger topics to the masses. And then you have stuff like South Park, which I think definitely leaned more into the satirical angle than The Simpsons have, especially in its latter seasons. Futurama makes some interesting commentary. There's a bunch of Adult Swim shows. I mean, Rick and Morty is a big one, too. Rick and Morty, I would say, is even more depressing and nihilistic than BoJack Horseman, and that's saying something. But again, going back to BoJack Horseman, they deal with such heavy and extreme, yet simultaneously relatable and human components. But I do feel like, to Raphael's point, I don't know what it is, but I get this idea of cartoon characters thinking that they're not necessarily real. Maybe it helps you kind of contextualize and digest the ideas more, because these aren't necessarily human characters that you're watching. These are pen and paper cartoons. You know, it's something that can easily dissociate your memory more or your mind more, that you focus more on the ideas that are coming across than maybe necessarily the people that are saying it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that sort of goes to what we were talking about earlier, is like the format of doing it through an animated show almost allows them to tackle these serious topics in a way that is more easily digestible. Because I think there's sometimes when you're hit with something like, oh, here's a 22-minute episode about abortion, like, yeah, I don't want to watch that. But when it's put through Sextina Aquafina, then maybe you're like, oh, okay, yeah, like, I, you know, this is something that's so silly. But then you start to get thinking, you're like, oh, this is like some serious shit.
Paul F. Tompkins gave a quote that Raphael referenced, where he said, "It's not a show for grown-ups, it's a show for adults." Or it might be the other way around, I'm not quite sure, but either way, I think he's highlighting a useful distinction there, because some of these animated shows that you see are quite dark and quite cynical, but not in a way that makes you engage with it. So like Family Guy, for instance, it's not PG-13, but it's not adult. You're not left sitting there after an episode of Family Guy thinking about and trying to unpack what you just saw. And likewise for a show like South Park, which gives topical commentary and it covers issues which are relevant to people's lives, but it's so on the nose that it's very clear what they're going for. And it always resets. So they do an episode on one thing and then that's it. They go and do an episode on something else and it just continues in that cycle. Whereas BoJack, I think, is trying to be an adult show. It's a show for people who are ready, and in some cases maybe not ready, to bear the emotional weight of what they're about to see.
The interesting thing to me is the fact that even comparing it to those other shows, it's much less crass, but it actually like knows where to place its crassness. I mean, up through season 3, there was like one fuck that was said in every season, but it was so strategically placed. You know, the first one was Herb telling, you know, BoJack to like get the fuck away from him. Season 2 was this heartbreaking episode where BoJack goes to stay at Charlotte's house. He ends up trying to, you know, get in bed with her daughter, and you have Charlotte tell him, like, get the fuck away from my house. Season three, you have BoJack bottoming out, you know, losing out on an Oscar nomination, and basically coming to a head finally with Todd about sort of the abuse he's been inflicting on him, and Todd says, like, fuck, what else is there to say? And it's so meaningful. You know, you don't have your South Park when they said shit 151 times in an episode. It really just shows from an emotional weight perspective in terms of writing that, like, yeah, they deal with some crass things sometimes. I mean, season four, there was a scene that I will never forget of a woman having sex with a dog, which I'm sure made a certain contingency of the internet very happy to think about that there's a show that now does that. But the fact that they strategically place some of these more adult elements in there just makes you realize, like, that's the significance of the situation. To Liana's point earlier, that's something that I'll always remember, is that, yeah, they might have dealt with some adult situations before. I mean, the show starts off with BoJack being, like, a washed-up, drunk drug addict, so they obviously deal with that stuff a lot. But the fact that they throw in curse words, for instance, very sparingly and only when the moment really calls for it, I think is extremely meaningful.
Mike, you said something on our Simpsons episode about how that show in some ways provided, like, a sexual awakening of a kind. I dare to think what happens to the kids for whom BoJack is their sexual awakening, because they're going to have some serious long-term damage going on there. But Mike, you mentioned Rick and Morty, and that's a show which is often brought up in comparison as if it's like a competition where you have to either think that one is better or the other. But I know that there's a lot of crossover between the two fan bases there. I think the main difference for me is that Rick and Morty is primarily an absurdist comedy show where so many crazy things are happening every episode, and it's so many laughs just back to back, and that is the focus. And even when the show goes to some dark places, it's always within that context. Whereas BoJack, in what I would say are some of its best episodes, they're willing to largely put the comedy aside and just engage in this character study for the length of the episode. And then the next week, they're back to the BoJack comedy that we all know and love. So I think it has a greater emotional range, even if you're just looking at, like, laughs per minute, Rick and Morty probably wins out there.
And I think also just this is obviously a very intelligently written show, both the jokes and the more serious side of things. So I think it's dealt with in a very intelligent, very smart, very grown up or adult, whichever the appropriate verbiage is there, way. And I think that, you know, that sort of plays into that large range from going from something that is so funny to something that is, you know, honestly really depressing, but is dealt with in a really smart manner.
And the animation provides a great backdrop for that, as we said. I think Lisa Hanawalt, in that same interview, gave the example of a director who always sets his movies at Christmas, even when there's no Christmas theme to the movie, even when it's not the right time of year for all of that to happen, just because those things trigger these positive emotions in viewers' minds, and that's the mentality he wants them to have coming into the movie. And I feel like animation, there's so much more color, not just literally, but also in terms of what you can do to prime the audience to think and react a certain way. So for a show like BoJack, which is largely about the kind of escapism that BoJack engages in, I don't know if you would be able to hit the same register if you were doing it just as a realistic show with human actors.
Yeah, the animation is just, and I love how much more confident they've gotten in their animation as the season has progressed, but to your point about the brightness, again, I don't want to compare the two cartoons too much, BoJack Horseman and Rick and Morty, but I feel like Rick and Morty has much more, I don't know, muted hues of their colors. And BoJack, one of the things that really drew me in were just the bright colors. Princess Carolyn is a pink cat. Mr. Peanut Butter is a yellow lab. And, you know, they're in Hollywood. They're in L.A., so they're under the sun a lot. So there's a lot of brightness to it, which then when you bring in these shadows, sometimes in these really brilliantly animated shots, like, you know, I always think of the one where BoJack in the aforementioned Escape from LA episode, when he's driving back to LA, there's this really interesting shot of the theme song playing as the camera, like, does a 360 pan around BoJack as he's sitting on the boat, which, you know, they don't really do that much. They're usually doing, like, the very traditional, like, 2D animated style. Obviously the fish out of water stuff, just the exploration in that environment was so interesting. And obviously season four, which I think it might be my favorite, just because Time's Arrow, the penultimate episode, is just, I mean, it's incredibly done. I really don't have words to describe it. It's so creative. And, you know, fortunately, I am not someone who has had to directly deal with Alzheimer's or dementia in my life. But I've heard on record people saying who have had, you know, closer encounters with it than I have, that like, that's a really creative but also pretty apt representation of what losing your memory is like, and what sort of tracking through your memories and like having things disappear and merge together and faces scribbled out, sort of what, how that might come across in one's mind. So those moments are the ones that will stick with me as well, the ones that really stick out from all the bright colors that already surround it.
But I mean, that's a thing actually, Mike, that the show I think does really well, is painting a lot of these either not frequently talked about or sort of negative situations in a very accurate light. Because I think I've also heard a lot about, you know, Todd's narrative of being asexual and people being really happy that there's somebody, you know, that it's being dealt with, it's actually being addressed. I mean, I think a lot of the marital problems that Mr. Peanut Butter and Diane go through, I mean, a lot of these things feel so eerily accurate and realistic, and, you know, then contrast it with the bright colors and the animation and all of that stuff. And so I think that that's one thing that makes the show really strong.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, I talked about this actually when I was on the Taran show, that, you know, when I watched Stupid Piece of Shit from the fourth season, which is essentially all BoJack's like mental narrative for a day, I love that it's done through like rudimentary, you know, crayon drawings that like a 7-year-old would do. But because it's sort of like these aggressive childlike thoughts, and I mean, it was not a sexual awakening, but I talked about how the fact that, you know, that was sort of an epiphany for me, where I had sort of thought that, okay, I have these thoughts, but I assume that everyone else does as well. And that was sort of like a big snap light bulb in my head for me of, oh, you're not supposed to feel this way. Okay, let me work on something to sort of help that, because I don't want that sort of thing running through my head all day long. So that was one big example, too, like to your point, Leon, about the fact that they do things in such interesting ways to make events stand out from the normal stuff and normal quotations, because it feels like there's always abnormal stuff going on in there, that it really sticks with you. It really has a wide array of animation styles to it, surprisingly so.
Yeah, and we do want to touch on all of those themes in some detail over the course of the episode. For now, though, let's circle back to the basic structure of the show, because it feels like there's a tension at work at the heart of BoJack Horseman. As you were saying, Mike, you can't reset at the end of every episode. You have to show some kind of character development over time, but also you know that so many of BoJack's flaws are deeply embedded in who he is. So you can't get that resolution after 30 minutes that they keep making fun of. So you have to walk this careful line between the show coming across as repetitive, where BoJack tries to be better, he fails horribly, and we just go back to that same well over and over again, or on the other end, there are only so many storylines you can explore in that universe, and if you try to push in too many directions, it gets too outlandish. So how do you think BoJack as a show has fared so far in managing their use of that space?
It's a good question. Yeah, because I'll admit, I sometimes get frustrated when, like, you have season 2, for instance, I think has a fantastic ending that could really work as a series finale, where you have this runner, literally a runner of a baboon, that every time we cut to BoJack's house, you see him sort of running up a hill, and you see BoJack try to run at the end, like everything has sort of went wrong for him, and he's trying to just sort of get his life back on track. And then you have this really small, but I mean, something that's really stuck with me is this baboon telling him, like, yeah, it's going to suck at first, but you have to keep doing it every day and it'll get better. And then we sort of get to the beginning of season 3 and he stopped doing that. And now he's back to who he is. That's a little sucky in terms of reverting back. But again, to Liana's point about things being realistic, I feel like that's often what happens. You know, when you set yourself on the path towards treatment and, you know, good mental health, it is not smooth sailing. There are many waves along the way that reset you back to a certain point, or that make you doubt yourself and then make you fall back into bad habits. And it's not going to be easy. So I can understand from both a plot perspective why they would do that. They obviously want to, you know, fill 12 episodes full of stuff. But at the same time, it also can be realistic in that, you know, it's one step forward and two steps back sometimes.
Right. I think at a certain point, though, right, it starts to sort of get into, it makes me think of the TV show House, where it's sort of the same pattern over and over and over again, where, you know, it's sort of the joke is like, oh, and I think Dom, I think you and Taryn talked about this, but it's like, oh, okay, well, House, you know, House doesn't figure it out. And then in the end, he comes up with this, you know, this like crazy idea because of something that 13 said or something like that. And so it almost feels like BoJack could take a similar route where it's sort of this same reused, okay, he's making progress, falls down again, making progress, falls down again. But I think that the way that the show has been handling it, at least thus far, has had enough variability within the storylines that still keeps it fresh for me. But I do think that, you know, if the show continues to go on for several more seasons, you know, how much variability then can you really have?
I think one thing that helps them get past that problem is the issue that we spoke about initially of having to establish all of these separate characters. When you're dealing with the first season, it makes it hard to piece that all together in a coherent way. But once you've done that, the payoff is quite large because it means that you have all of these different tracks that you can send these characters down. So when BoJack is stuck in this spiral of doing the same thing over and over again, well, you can take some time off to focus on what's Todd and Mr. Peanut Butter's latest crazy scheme, or what issues is Princess Carolyn trying to work through, or where's Diane in the world at this given moment. So you have these different subplots, which can feel a bit arbitrary sometimes in the context of any one episode, but in terms of the larger narrative, it gives them so much more room to work with when they're trying to plot out where all our characters are going to be a season and a half from now.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely is the benefit of an ensemble cast, where you've actually fleshed out all of the other characters and taking the time to do that, you know, from the first season on, which definitely, I think, to your point, makes it easier for them to then explore what's going on in the rest of the BoJack Horseman world.
Yeah, I'm trying to like look at the five characters. And I guess I'm trying to think about, I don't know, whose subplots do I like the most? I do feel like, while obviously BoJack is the face of the show, I feel like Princess Carolyn is the heart. In that, you know, hers is some, I don't know, for some reason, even though BoJack deals with some really depressing stuff, hers always feel like the most depressing storylines, because like she's very clear about what she wants, but she's never able to get it, whether it's because of work, whether it's because of romance, or the fact that she was dating for a while someone who was clearly three kids stacked on top of each other wearing a trench coat with a broom for an arm, or this heartbreaking episode in season four where, you know, she had been trying to get pregnant with Ralph for so long, and then we get this sort of like introduction. It was also like a How I Met Your Mother episode of like, here's a future kid Carolyn giving a speech about her ancestor, and it turns out that this was all fabricated, that, you know, she lost the baby and then her life sort of spun out from there. And I think Amy Sedaris just does such a good job. I mean, it's crazy to think that she went from like Jerry Blank to this. I do think that nearly all these performers are putting in like career best performances, specifically Will Arnett and Amy Sedaris. I love the fact that the show is allowing them to do so much dramatically as well, that Princess Carolyn is just, I want things to go so well for her. And I think it just speaks to how well the character is written.
Oh, I love Princess Carolyn so much. There is one line series of lines that really just hit me so hard. I think it was, she was talking about like, oh, so yesterday you let yourself fell in love a little bit. You got your heart broken. Serves you right for having feelings. It's just like, oh, like I just got hit in the gut. Oh my God. I love her storylines. I think she is probably my favorite character in the show, but it is just so much fun to have a really diverse set of different stories that are being told. You know, especially contrast that right with Todd and what's going on in Todd's world. And it's really nice to have all ensemble together in one show.
Princess Carolyn sometimes feels like the moral conscience of the show, almost, where she comes so close to being this relatable, grounded character, and in many ways she is, and yet she also knows that she's never going to get what she wants, and in part she has her own psychological hang-ups that will stop her from getting there. And I think the episodes that center around her, so her episode in, I think it's episode 7 of the first season, and then the Ruthie episode that Mike was talking about, those are often some of the most compelling episodes just from a character development standpoint, even if they're maybe not the funniest or the darkest.
I also I'm trying to think, I think it might be season 3. There's an episode where it's almost like a bottle episode. It's BoJack and Princess Carolyn at that restaurant where like they essentially like they sort of talk through their relationship, because going in, you know, they were sleeping together, but it's clear it was like a toxic relationship, and they're finally able to talk about their feelings. But in true BoJack fashion, there is this insane background subplot about how the chef quits, and then the waiter becomes the chef, and then this kid becomes this parent becomes the waiter, and then the kid becomes the parent, and then they have to be all impressive food critic. It's just ridiculous. But I do love the show, as we've been talking about a lot throughout this podcast, gives time to dedicate to these characters because it gives them such complexity. I love the turn that they took with Todd as well. I'm glad that they realized when they were getting to a certain point of like, yeah, we can't just have Todd be the zany guy who's sort of a savant at the same time. You know, we'll so they end up coming with this interesting complex, sort of making him asexual. But they still throw on top of there that he comes up with a scheme to make a clown dentistry business. Well, half of them are clowns who are trained to be dentists, and the other half are dentists trained to be clowns, and they'll just train each other.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I love that. What's that? They have some really great names also that I will look up. But yeah, I mean, I think that that's what's fun. I mean, I think about the fact you have all of these just really different storylines. I mean, go back to what I was saying before. I mean, just Todd's are so ridiculous. Like his Disneyland knockoff thing that he tries to build, his giant papier-mâché head, like what is going on? And then you have this really, the seriousness, which is something I enjoy.
Let's talk about Todd's character quickly, because J.D. Salinger, in what might be my favorite episode of BoJack, possibly just TV in general, berates Todd by saying, Big Nose Todd wasn't funny, Zombie Todd wasn't funny, Pretty Lady Todd wasn't funny, and this isn't funny. And there is something to that, that any one of Todd's crazy schemes, they're fun to watch a lot of the time, but there's not enough there to carry an episode by itself. And it sometimes does feel like, in the midst of a more ambitious main plot, we have to give our obligatory 2 minutes to find out what Todd is up to on any given day. And it would be easy for that to become kind of cheap or shallow. And so you see this attempt to expand his character more in season four, which I've seen some people say is, it feels kind of out of the blue or a bit forced. But I think the way that Todd's character is set up, almost any development of that kind would feel that way. And if you can do that in a way which gives a voice to people who just haven't seen their issues discussed on TV before in a way that they feel is sensitive to it, then why not?
Yeah, and I think that there's actually an episode, there's an episode called Hooray Todd episode in season four, which doesn't even crack into the asexual thing. It's this entire day of Todd sort of digging into this complex that he has where he feels like he needs to help people no matter what. And you see him sort of jumping between all these things that he's agreed to do. And then it ends with him like finally finding solace in this group of like, you know, not Asexuals Anonymous, but like a group of like-minded people that meet together. And I think that's really poignant because, you know, even if you feel like that the asexual thing might be forced, there's at least other aspects of his personality that they're exploring. Ever since they had him utter that fuck at the end of season three, I feel like he's a fundamentally changed character, which is good because Aaron Paul is fantastic. And I'm glad because he might have been a little one note to begin with, you know, definitely flanderizing him a bit sometimes to make him so incredibly vapid, but somehow failing up, that I'm glad they take the time to explore it a bit more and not just, as shows are wont to do as their seasons continue, make them more and more two-dimensional just for the sake of joke.
Up is my favorite direction in which to fail, and Todd does a good job of that. But I do see what you're saying, that he does feel almost a bit Jason Mendoza-ish sometimes, where it's,
yeah,
when the focus is, oh, look how dumb Todd is, there's only so much mileage you can get out of that. And so I think if you're going to have him be this main character over the course of four seasons, you need to find new ways to expand that. And it looks like that's what they're doing. I wonder if his role in a larger sense is, you know, everybody else has this internal struggle that they, these hang-ups, this self-doubt that they're working through. And with Todd, it's hard to imagine him even really having that, at least the Todd that we see in the first few seasons. So he might be this kind of counterweight to show that even if you don't have that, even if you're just kind of living life in a unfiltered way, that you just do what you feel like, that's not going to guarantee satisfaction. And we see Todd realize the course of that unhappiness in the fourth season, and that's where his character really comes into its own.
I think Todd also acts as sort of this, I don't know, I want to say antagonist, but against BoJack. I mean, because I think, you know, when he says the word fuck in that conversation, really this is Todd stepping up up against BoJack and being this sort of force against him in some way to make BoJack realize what's going on. So it almost, in part, Todd's character development almost comes through his interactions with BoJack because their storylines are so intertwined.
You see that lack of development too in, or lack of definition rather, in a lot of these Todd subplots, where so many of them revolve around him pretending to be other people. So why he's Prince Gustav and the next day he's someone else. And that, I think that speaks to his larger lack of identity almost, that no one even knows or cares who Todd is. He's just BoJack's wacky sidekick.
I will say, though, that I do love his... I am privy to his schemes with Mr. Peanut Butter, but specifically, there's the meerkat accountant played by Jake Johnson from New Girl, who I think is a fantastic straight man to it. I remember one in particular, I think it's beginning of season three, where they drive to his house when he finally gets to spend time with his son and, like, kidnaps him to take him away and explain their schemes to him. But I just remember him being like, son, like, don't forget me. He's like, don't worry, I'll listen to this song that we always want to listen together, Cats in the Cradle. And he's like, no, son, no, this will have my ironic meaning now. Don't listen to it alone. Can we talk for a second about Fish Out of Water? Again, I don't want to keep going back to the episode, but I feel like, I mean, that was so critically lauded. I mean, I feel like it really won BoJack Horseman, and I can definitely be fact checked on this because I can probably be wrong on this. Really won its like first award accolade, and I mean, I think it just shows the depth, literally, that the show can go in terms of versatility and creativity in its structure. Because I mean, it's an entirely silent episode, and silent isn't like mime, but I feel like it does such a great job telling a story without giving words to it, which BoJack is so good at words as a show, that when you rob the show of it on paper, you think, okay, this might not necessarily work, but it almost adds even more emotionally compelling elements to it because no words can be involved.
And how they were able to do it through animation is still just beyond me. I mean, I think that you have a show that, yeah, is really the strength of the show is built on its writing and the dialogue, and to deprive it of that, then to still be so strong through the combination of the strength of the animation and the music, I think, that play during this episode. Because, yeah, like you said, it's essentially there's zero dialogue once they end up going underwater. And I think this episode was rightfully praised because it really is something that is just visually gorgeous. The, you know, like I said, the music, and to convey emotion the way it does without any dialogue is just it's amazing.
It's a very bold experiment for a show that hinges so much on this verbal back and forth, on the wordplay that permeates every single aspect of the show's universe. But not just that, you have this all-star cast of voice actors who really help to give life to these amazing characters. And so to sacrifice all of that to take a risk on this, it's a very bold call, and it's one that I think definitely paid off.
Yeah, I think so as well. And the fact that, you know, then put that into the fact that, to Liana's point earlier, they just have these generally creative ways to deal with some of these bigger elements. I mean, this is BoJack pretty much, you know, usually hates children, but then he's sort of saddled with this little seahorse that he needs to sort of bumble around with to get it back to its mother. And maybe that sort of segues into like his own perspective parental dealings with Hollyhock in season four. But BoJack Horseman also sort of brought up this idea of doing sort of like a topics episode every season to go back to that idea, because season two had, you know, Herb After Dark, which is or Hank After Dark, which is the sort of its take on the like Bill Cosby, David Letterman, predating all the Me Too Harvey Weinstein stuff, but essentially talking about how sometimes in the world of celebrity, when these horrible things are happening, sometimes name supersedes really any sort of moral punishment. Season three has that aforementioned Brat Brat Pew Pew abortion episode. Season four has Thoughts and Prayers. Do you think that this is now sort of like a hallmark of each BoJack Horseman season, that they sort of take an episode to embrace these larger ideas, no matter what sort of creativity might be utilized in it?
I mean, I think definitely looking at those specific examples that you brought up, yeah, it's like it's one episode that sort of centers around this this very serious topic, which it's still crazy to me that Hank After Dark episode came out in 2015. Like, it just sounds like something could come out tomorrow. But I think that those episodes in particular do focus on that, but I still think that you have that idea that then, you know, or at least those topics permeate really the whole, you know, the whole season. So to have one episode that focuses on it, I mean, I don't know if it's one, two, like, what would you say from episode four? I mean, I guess Thoughts and Prayers, but also like, yeah, Commence Fracking, you know, or is then another, although I guess that one was a little bit more silly. So I think that it's not necessarily just one episode. I think there are examples, like you, the ones that you mentioned, Mike, where really do address one specific topic, but the show really does address so many other really serious topics that permeate throughout the whole season. So that's also another element.
Do you feel those episodes work in the context of the show? Because if you look at those four examples, BoJack Hates the Troops came along before the show really had any hallmarks to speak of. So it felt a little bit out of place, but out of place in a great way at that time. And then the Hank Hippopopolis episode, it seems eerily prophetic now. It, as Liana said, it's strange to think it came out when it did. And then the abortion and guns episodes, as far as I know, were not as critically lauded as just the average BoJack episode. And on their own terms, they do what they're trying to do pretty well. But they do feel like these set-piece episodes, where if you're rewatching the season and you skip those, you don't lose anything in the narrative. And then also, if you aren't watching the season and you just watch them, you don't really need to know much about BoJack as a universe to understand those episodes.
Yeah, I wonder if it's because the show is, yes, it's about these more internal constructs, but at its center, it's about this idea of Hollywood. I wonder if the further the show strays from Hollywood in what it's talking about, maybe the less it plays on the audience. Because like Hank After Dark is great because it talks about this specific idea of how, you know, your name can be big enough that it doesn't make you culpable for certain mm-hmm. things. That if you have such a great image in the eye of the public, no one will believe you if you come to them with certain things. And you could see through like Brat Brat Pew Pew deals with this Sextina Aquafina, you know, dealing through it through the pop cult, the celebrity lens, Thoughts and Prayers deal with it through like the we have to get a movie shot and we can't do it because now there are guns there and there was a mass shooting. Let's try to like get things passed. Though I do feel like there was one thing that went around, you know, amidst all the gun control debate nowadays that I think by the end of it, I think it's Diane who says like, you know, people would rather get rid of guns than like give a gun to a woman or something like that. I feel like that's become very, you know, it's popped up a bunch in the months since. But yeah, I wonder if it's maybe they're less successful because they're speaking out towards topics that don't necessarily exist within the Hollywood circle, and therefore it seems to fit a little bit less than something like Hank After Dark.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I can understand it from sort of a critic's perspective of why that could be the case. But I think just for me, the fact that the show like this is sort of willing to tackle topics like that and be so upfront about it, but again, in a very smart way, not in a crass cursing all the time, you know, sort of South Park way, which I love South Park for what it is. But I think the strength of BoJack is the fact that it is able to address a lot of these serious issues from that, like we've talked about, or like I've mentioned so many times, that weird mixture of sort of silliness, but also very serious in a very respectful way.
To keep going back to Raphael Bob Waxberg, he had in that same interview a quote saying that the biggest way The Simpsons influenced him was that he felt that was a great example of telling sad stories in a way that didn't sacrifice comedy and telling funny stories in a way that didn't sacrifice character and sacrifice emotions. So that speaks to the larger point that we've been making. But I think it also ties in here too, where if once you hit your rhythm and you understand what your show is about, you can try to take on these issues, but in a way that is quintessentially BoJack or quintessentially whatever the show is that you're making.
Mm-hmm. The worry is that if it ever gets like so heavy-handed that it feels very proselytizing in some sort of way. But at least at this point for me, I haven't felt that way.
So we speak about this experimentation that the show is willing to go towards now, whether it's with these topical episodes, whether it's with a completely silent episode. And you have stuff beyond that, too. So the premiere of season 4, for instance, doesn't feature the titular character. Like BoJack, who mm-hmm. is what the show is about, is just not there. And that speaks to the faith that they've developed in the rest of the cast at this point, that they're able and willing to do that. But over the course of these four seasons, do you think the show has changed in a fundamental way? And I know the fourth season, for instance, tonally it feels a little bit different, and I had trouble placing my finger on exactly what that was until I watched it, but I'm curious if you agree and you have any theories as to why.
See, I don't really rewatch the seasons before the next one comes out, which I should probably do. So like I could see looking back that season 4 feels totally different, but I think at the time I was watching it, I'm like, oh, this is just BoJack. I have to remember that it could be dark sometimes. But yeah, thinking about it, if we're talking about more the creative directions that the show is going in, I feel like you could see a lot of experimentation in season 4. I mean, you talked about that first episode, See Mr. Peanut Butter Run, which seems like a fairly, you know, typical BoJack episode, except for the fact that BoJack isn't in it. We have Stupid Piece of Shit, as we mentioned. We have Time Zero, as we mentioned. But the episode after See Mr. Peanut Butter Run is the old Sugarman place, which employs this this storytelling device of simultaneously going between the past and the present in the same house. And the choice was interesting to sort of, I feel like season four was the first one to really have an overarching storyline, if that makes sense. Like, season three had some stuff to deal with the characters, and it sort of came to an understanding by the end. But season four felt a little different because it seemed like it was telling one long story about BoJack's mother. And I think it comes beautifully. It really culminates in this Time Zero episode, which really connects back to everything that's going on, even if you think it's completely extraneous everything as the season progresses. But the fact that they spend the second episode basically entirely concentrating on BoJack's lineage is not something that I would necessarily think the show would do in its first three seasons.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point, because I think that the previous season sort of, you know, you build up, you have some sort of climax, where it feels like this season really was, if you tie episodes 2 and 11 together as sort of this one overarching story, that, yeah, there's elements of building, but it just feels like you're really just learning more and more. It's almost like you have a picture, and slowly the pieces are being exposed, and you're able to see more about, you know, about BoJack's mother and how her actions affected him, and sort of how that kind of explains previous behavior. I think also another element about season four and why it may have felt different tonally is because there are sort of more of those seasons that, or those episodes that do kind of feel a little bit like they could be watched in isolation, I think, and also ones that sort of deal with more serious topics, like the fact that you have Commence Fracking, Thoughts and Prayers, and Stupid Piece of Shit all together, sort of three episodes in a row. I think that's maybe another reason why it could feel a little different.
So the first few seasons, you had BoJack, and you have this other cast that interacts with each other and with BoJack, but those stories felt more interconnected, whereas this season you have Mr. Peanut Butter and Diane and their relationship troubles, which it's always been a subplot that they go back to sometimes, but this season that was their main story arc. And so Mr. Peanut Butter, who could reliably be the source of humor when the show desperately needed it, he's not as reliable at that anymore, because so many of his storylines are about him and about his own internal struggles, and he can't just suddenly perk up and have the perfect witticism for the moment. And same thing with Todd, actually. He kind of does that too. So the show doesn't have this reliable source of comedy anymore, but then also BoJack has burned so many bridges by now that some of those relationships can't really exist in the same way. So coming out of the end of last season, if BoJack and Todd were just on great terms again in the premiere, it would feel like a cop-out, like the show wasn't faithful to its own history. So there has to be some level of distance that slowly gets repaired. And you understand that, but at first you don't really appreciate it as much as a viewer.
And it's heartbreaking, but I love that they, again, stick canonically with these relationships that BoJack has burned, even outside of, like, the main cast. Like, someone like Charlotte or Kelsey, who's the Maria Bamford voiced director previously of Secretariat, who gets fired because she decides to do BoJack's idea of, like, sneaking in to film this scene that he wants to put in Secretariat. I think that they're so meaningful, and these are sort of like landmarks that we can refer to as we travel with BoJack through this emotional map where things don't reset. You know, maybe the main characters will begrudgingly learn to, like, work with each other again, but no matter what, there are going to be these monumental times in BoJack's life that we have now experienced with him that are unshakable. They're never going to be sort of moved. You can't rebuild that bridge. And I think that's highly significant in telling sort of the emotional journey that he's going on, because it's very realistic. We don't necessarily patch things up with people all the time. There might be traumatizing incidents that make you, you know, ruminate on them for the rest of your life.
Well, because what's that quote where, you know, I think BoJack, who says life can't be wrapped up neatly in 22 minutes. And yeah. I think that that's something that the show obviously really clearly follows. And so you see that continuation from episode to episode, but within seasons, within relationships. And that is something that makes it unique.
If the show has a mission statement or a series of mission statements, I think that's one of them, is that BoJack also has this quote about closure being this made up thing. Like, you can't just wrap everything up and just dispose of it as if nothing happened and just move on to the next thing, because these form a continuous strand throughout your life, and you have to accept that and work with it, and failing to do that will inevitably lead to worse things in the future.
Aww. Well, we were gonna be, we were gonna get different at one point, but the, but I love about it though, just because I don't know, I find it, and this might be my own like selfish proclivities, but it, it feels so releasing to me, just because, again, this is me speaking a bit autobiographically, but as someone who had sort of been dealing with these ideas, perhaps in denial for such a big part of my life, I don't know, it's so satisfying to me almost to see these issues be talked about on a show. You know, it's something that sort of helps me grasp things. It's something that helps me sort of deal with the realities that might come with being an adult or a grown up. But sometimes it's just nice to know that some people are going through the same shit you are, to feel that you're not so alone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 1,000%. I mean, I think for me, like personally, both Princess Carolyn and then Diane and her relationship with Mr. Peanut Butter were like very, very important for me to see. And I think that, yeah, there's sort of the element of like, oh, I made myself sad, to quote Futurama. But then when you start thinking about it, you just, it's nice to see, like you said, Mike, somebody else is going through this, or there are examples of this and you're not alone. And you, you know, you sort of have, yeah, just a sense of that you're, you know, you're not isolated. And so that's something that I enjoy about BoJack.
BoJack, I think, is a show that it exists in a time when people binge shows, and even shows that are not meant to be binged, that is the default mode of viewing for a lot of people. And I think BoJack, in a way, that helps it a lot, because when the show is having trouble finding its feet or finding its hooves in those early stages, if the show has a weak episode, in the normal like episodic format, if you had to wait a week before the next episode, you might think, it's not worth coming back next Monday, I have better things to do with my time. When you can instantly fire up the next episode and it hooks you back in and shows you what drew you to the show in the first place, then it's easier to overlook that. And I think it's the kind of show which I don't know if it's a natural binging show, but it feels like it's comfortable existing with that assumption in mind.
Well, I think also BoJack, sort of like Arrested Development, a show that has a lot of repeated gags that you almost need to watch a couple episodes in a row in order to really pick up on them, like the, you know, Hollywood, right? I mean, that's something that continues throughout the rest of the season. And so, you know, you, if it was a week-to-week episode, you might forget about stuff like that. And I think that it loses some of the powerfulness of this, the subtle comedy, but it is something that it really stands out when you're able to binge it.
Yeah, my watching, because I'm not a huge binge watcher, but I usually do about when, you know, from it the day it comes out, I usually watch about two a day or so, because this is also a show that deals with a lot of heavy shit, and I fear that if you binge too much, you will feel absolutely gutted by the end of it. So sometimes you need to take some time away to like step out and then, you know, get your mind out of a cartoon show for a little bit. So I usually, and that also lets me marinate a bit in like some, the brilliance that can happen and just all the random little bits and pieces. Cause sometimes when you watch them all together, they all sort of smooth over into one big joke or two that you might remember when there are, oh, so many little nuggets packed in there.
And the show, I think, gestures towards that too. So if you're binging a show that is just, unequivocally a funny show, then it's easy to just slam 10 episodes of that together, and maybe some of the jokes go over your head or they all blur together a little bit, but that's fine, that's not going to ruin you psychologically. You have this very stark contrast between the very heavy episodes and the more lighthearted episodes. So when you're binging, you go on this roller coaster of emotions where it's not universally heavy, it's not universally light, but it sends you to these peaks and valleys multiple times in the space of a few hours if you're watching back to back.
Yeah, that's a good point, because when I think about shows that I actually have to stop watching, I think about shows like Black Mirror, where it's like you're getting hit for long periods of time. And I think BoJack does have enough of the ups and downs to make it easier for me to digest, you know, watching so many episodes at once.
And there is a tie in there to the issues of mental health that the show continually brings up too, because you know when you're watching BoJack that there is going to be an episode or two that will crush you emotionally. You can sometimes predict when that's going to be. You know, the penultimate episode of every season is best left avoided if you're not willing to handle that at the time. But part of suffering from the issues that the show highlights is not being able to stop yourself from engaging in behavior that you know will make you miserable. And one of the easiest things to do when you're in that kind of funk is to just plow through a season of a show that you've seen 10 times, even if you know that some of what it deals with, it will send you to a dark place that you probably don't want to go to otherwise.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's, I don't know if it purposely like wanted to market itself to end up on Netflix. But I guess it's ironic then that, you know, in a show that is about compulsion and trying to resist that compulsive behavior sometimes, that it ends up on a platform which is known for its binge-watching and mess.
And there's one final point on the binge-worthiness of it. It's a show when, even if I'm watching 10 episodes back-to-back, I will sit through, I will allow myself to enjoy the opening and closing credits every single time, because the show, it would be very easy for, like, most theme songs or most like outro music or whatever to get stale with time, but somehow BoJack doesn't. It feels so perfect for the show in a way that's hard to articulate.
Oh, it's so good. I hate that skip intro button on Netflix. Mm-hmm. I'm like, go away, skip intro button.
I don't know. I mean, I could say, like, it might apply to some. Like, I love Orange is the New Black, but, like, eventually I get a little tired of Regina Spektor, you know, when you do it, like, 13 times in a row.
How dare you, Mike?
Yeah, how dare you, Mike?
But I do love BoJack thing because it's entirely instrumental, and I love, like, I think I saw someone actually write up, they might have dug too much into the meaning of it, but this whole thing about how, like, the saxophone represents BoJack's longing or something, but the intro is so much fun. I also love the little things, and you have to, they almost make you watch the intro because all the little changes that they put in there, you know, like, mm-hmm. they'll have meaningful characters appear in the party, and then when they disappear from the show, they're no longer in the party. Certain canonical things will appear and disappear, depending on what's going on the show at the time. And then, yeah, I do love the closing credits. I mean, I feel like if people ever want a description of what the show is about, just have them listen to that ending credit song, and they basically get a good description of the baseline of the show in terms of plot.
I thought the saxophone was just, it sounds like a horse whinnying, but maybe I don't have the understanding to appreciate it. Maybe I'm the Todd, and everyone else is the BoJack.
Clearly, you just don't understand what the saxophone really means.
It's a metaphor. Everything is a metaphor.
Everything is a metaphor.
That's right. I think one of my favorite intro gags is the when the ottoman, Sarah Lynn lights the ottoman on fire, and then the next episode, you see the ottoman in the background, and it's burnt. Like, that's, I mean, that attention to detail, oh, it's just so good.
Mike, when we spoke about The Simpsons, we took a brief detour to talk about Itchy and Scratchy, and we could afford to have that be a detour, because if you remove that from The Simpsons universe, it would be less rich as a result. There are lots of episodes which you go back to that constantly, and they're better for having done it. But in this case, horsing around is the context for the show. BoJack would not exist without horsing around. So when we see glimpses of it, I don't think it's meant to be funny, and it's not meant to be a show, like, it's not meant to be great, a great work of drama, but how are we meant to feel about it within the context of BoJack?
Yeah, in this world, Ibsen is played by an ibex. Yeah, I feel like it's a good question, because I think initially it was meant to be taken as sort of this chintzy Full House knockoff, right? Of here's a horse who adopted three orphans, but then it sort of serves as, like, sometimes they go back to it to sort of show, like, how far BoJack has fallen, or, like, the profound effect that he's had not only on the people he interacted with, but, like, the people that watched him. I mean, there's this one moment where he does Ethan around, which is sort of like the Fuller House, where the little child actor says, when I grow up, I want to be just like you. And that causes BoJack to freak out and run away, because I think it sort of made him come to terms with how much this became both the best and worst thing in his life, because it just sort of, it magnified his better qualities and how talented he was, but it also magnified his worst qualities in really just showcasing to certain people, you know, how callous he can be, how selfish he can be, how impulsive he can be sometimes. So I feel like they focus less and less on horsing around, maybe because they just feel like there's less to go back to. They did have an interesting, between seasons one and two, they had like a Christmas special where Todd and BoJack watched the horsing around Christmas special. That was okay. Like, it wasn't really saying that much, and they focused a lot on horsing around, which wasn't really, as you said, Dom, like, when it's not done ironically, it's really not that funny. But I guess it sort of looms as this big specter above BoJack's life, that he's always sort of trying to outrun it to say, like, I know him for just more than horsing around.
Mike, what are you talking about? Nay way, Jose.
Go home, Goober.
Go home, Goober. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because I think that originally the concept of horsing around as being a part of the show was just, like you said, this sort of knockoff. But it really has become a way for the writers to tell new stories for BoJack and for the other characters, sort of develop them, how they got here, how Horsin' Around really fits in and sort of drove the narrative. I mean, especially when it comes to Sarah Lynn. And so what seems like it sort of started is just this really, you know, sort of low hanging fruit joke, I think, has evolved into something that really works as a storytelling device.
Even BoJack admits at points that it's not a great show. And yet the creators are very careful to show that despite all of that, the show can mean a lot to people. And that meaning is determined by what they give it, what it does for them. So in that same interview that we keep going back to, Raphael says, quote, "There's a big conversation between Diane and BoJack about how important their smarchy shows were for a lot of people and still are and what they need. I think it's very easy to dismiss them. And a lot of our show certainly does critique them and show the cynicism of them or emptiness of them. But I want to be very conscious as well that there is a beauty to them. I think the world of BoJack Horseman has always sat uncomfortably between those two points. Firstly, that this kind of narrative is shallow and empty, but on the other hand, that it's very helpful and wonderful. I definitely think that's a balance that we try to keep as we make the show. And I think they do a good job of that, by and large."
Yeah, I think that sort of lies in the role of Mr. Peanut Butter, who was sort of set up initially to sort of be the antagonist to BoJack, and I'm very glad we stopped going in that direction, because that's a little stock to me. But here's someone who, to your point, is sort of known for this role, but he embraces it fully. He absolutely loves it, and it just shows that there can be people that, you know, are not as cynical to this as someone like BoJack or Diane is. You have someone like Sir who fully embraces the chintziness of it, and he loves every second of it.
But are you a Zoe or a Zelda?
Oh, big question, as per usual.
I was going to bring this up. Do we think that's a useful way of classifying people? And if so, which are you?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. Which one is which? Which is
that's the essential question. Yeah,
because one of them's more like a cat, and one of them's more like a dog. That's sort of how I feel like it. Which is also how I sort of put Mr. Peanut Butter and Diane, where Diane is more of a cat, and Peanut Butter is literally a dog.
I'm pretty sure Zeldas are the Mr. Peanut Butters, the optimistic, positive people, and the Zoes are the cats. And if you're a cat person, which you should be, it seems like that's sending the wrong message, maybe.
I think I'm probably a Zoe. I think, Mike, you got to be a Zelda, right?
Mike is definitely a Zelda. Yeah,
that's why we work so well together, Liana, is that exactly. We've got both Z's taken care of.
The concept of Zeldas means nothing if Mike is not a Zelda. Like that is just, right. He fits the archetype so well.
You know, we talked about Princess Carolyn, so I'll shine some light on Diane, because, I mean, first of all, Alison Brie does a great job of downplaying it, because I think, at least I'm used to seeing her play some of these more the Zelda roles, the more, like, perky, energetic, over-the-top characters, which she does a great job. I mean, hell, her role in the Lego movie was essentially that to a T. But I mean, maybe this is sort of the millennial side speaking up in me, but I do love the elements that they deal with her in seasons 2 and 3, specifically, of, like, what do you want to do with your life, and sort of chasing after things only to realize that those aren't necessarily the things that you want to do, and sort of figure out your life from there, and how do you maintain relationships while also trying to figure out what you want to do, and do they like counter to each other? I think that it's a really well-constructed character, and I think it deals a lot with themes specifically with her and BoJack, where they similarly resonate in terms of figuring out next steps and trying to essentially put together where you fit into the puzzle of life as a piece, even though their ages are very much separate.
Yeah, I mean, I think as far as characters that really do resonate with me, I mean, the comments, Mike, that you were making about Diane, about sort of this, like, figuring out what you want to do, and I think when Diane goes, runs away with, oh my god, what's his face, who's voiced by Keegan-Michael Key?
Yeah, I'll bat up.
Yeah, so... Dante. Yeah, so
Sebastian St. Clair.
Sebastian St. Clair, yes. So, you know, she runs away and then, you know, is going to do all these wonderful things, but then, you know, comes back and really has this hard time sort of facing reality and facing Mr. Peanut Butter about what actually happened. And you really sort of see this inner turmoil within her about sort of wanting to do, like, quote unquote, the right thing, but then also doing what, you know, is sort of natural to her, what makes her happy, but then also not being happy doing it. And I think a lot of that inner turmoil is something that was really another person go through. I mean, essentially as somebody who especially was sort of trying to like figure everything out and figure my life out. But then also Princess Carolyn's, if I could like sort of mash the two characters together, that would like be me. And then Princess Carolyn, somebody who is so well accomplished, but still has sort of these elements of her life that she, you know, isn't happy with and kind of hides and blocks all of that and, you know, tries to be this like hard career gal. She has her like montage of her running on the treadmill. You know, I think that that's something that it's really nice to see just really well developed female characters.
Princess Carolyn has a quote, I think it might be in the first episode, actually, where she says that she's very good at compartmentalizing. So she's able to separate her personal life from her professional life. And I think we see over the course of the show's run how difficult that is, both in general and in Hollywood specifically, and also how it might not even be a desirable idea, because it means that these people who have shown themselves to be toxic in a certain context, you find reason to let them re-enter your life. And we see that with BoJack, who I think, despite them having touching moments at times, it's very clear Princess Carolyn's life would probably be better if BoJack wasn't in it anymore. And yet there's something that either he understands about her or she understands about him that neither of them can really find elsewhere. And that tortured relationship is one of the most compelling among any of the characters in the show.
Yeah, and I'll shine some light on Mr. Peanut Butter as well, just because I feel like you could take a lot of stuff that we were attributing to Todd earlier and ascribe it to Mr. Peanut Butter too, where he started out as like a pretty one-note character, played very well, but still pretty one-note. I'm glad that we got into some deeper, granted, still pretty shallow motivations, but, you know, motivations within him. You know, there's this entire storyline in season 3 where his brother comes in, played by Weird Al Yankovic, and you have this guy who basically makes his life out of not dealing with really serious things, now having to deal with really serious things in his life with his brother possibly dying. That's something that I know that I've sort of had to come to terms with over the past couple of years being a Zelda and all. So I appreciate that the sort of the depths that they're sort of letting him plumb while at the same time still keeping his character true of, you know, the first episode of season 4 is him somehow winning this ski race, you know, sticking at it, even though like he doesn't really want the job. So, you know, he is, again, sort of him and Todd are both sort of in this Ralph Wiggum, Jason Mendoza, Andy Dwyer camp where you can be really dumb and over the top sometimes, but there is some heart to it. And with Mr. Peanut Butter specifically, they do play sometimes into his greater motivations as a, I was about to say person, but obviously that's not the applicable term.
Well, and I think so to talk about BoJack specifically, I think that, you know, with BoJack, there's, yeah, he has his own personal issues, but the fact is that it sort of comes from the fact that he's inherited his trauma. And that is something that, you know, we're all affected by elements that happen, whether it is our family or it's things that have just happened to us in the past. And sort of having BoJack explore how, especially in season 4, how these, you know, previous elements and like the pain of his parents then ended up impacting him and sort of where that this trauma is sort of passed on and on and on is just a really interesting concept to think about, and something that that is unique to BoJack, I think, specifically in the show.
How do you both feel about the Peanut Butter and, or Mr. Peanut Butter and Diane relationship? Because it's the most long-lasting relationship on the show, and it looks like it's coming under considerable strain. And there was a quote a few seasons back that we're only 5 big fights away from a divorce, and there are people out there who have been counting the fights, and we're getting pretty close to this now. So is this something that we see in the near future? And if so, does it speak to some fundamental incompatibility, or is this just the usual struggle that any relationship has to go through at some point?
Well, this is like really for me to talk about, because okay. I had essentially gone through a divorce that was a very sort of similar situation where my husband was, ex-husband now, was very much a Mr. Peanut Butter kind of type. And I was very much more a Diane. And there is this quote in, I think it's definitely in season 4. I want to say it's the very last episode where Diane is talking about how, you know, when you squint, it's our relationship is like one of those
magic eye posts.
Yeah, it's one of those magic eye paintings. And when you squint just right, you line everything up, it's perfect. But then she breaks down. She says, but I'm tired of squinting. And I think that was sort of oh my God, I think I started bawling when I watched that episode, because that in my mind, that definitely captivated definitely encapsulated my relationship, because it was like, this relationship works really well when we look at it from really one very narrow perspective, but in so many different other areas, it's just falling apart. And I sort of feel that like Diane and Mr. Peanut Butter, again, this is like, because I have a very, very, very specific POV coming from this perspective is like, no, this is a fundamental compatibility issue of not agreeing on how you want your future to move forward. And so I don't, I mean, I would say that this is something that's a compatibility issue, not just something that all couples go through. But that is my personal experience.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the optimist in me would like to say that, like, you know, they've been through all this, they'll still stay together. But it seemed like, especially at the end of the season, they were really coming to terms of, like, I mean, in that episode that you just mentioned, Liana, that's when they're like, okay, we moved to this new house. This isn't fixing things. Okay, let's go to Hawaii. You know, now that they built this land bridge with that bill in the gun episode. But I think they sort of realized in that episode that, you know, we were essentially trying to run away from our reality and we can't do that. Now, does that mean that they're going to get divorced in this season, in season 5, whenever it premieres? I don't think so. What I am very confident about is that if and when they do separate, I'm very happy that they don't put Diane back with BoJack.
Yes. 'Cause
that was sort of a weird thing looking back in season 1 that you're like, all right, do we really have to go down this path? And I'm glad that once she left and came back, like, it was no longer romantic. They sort of comrades in misery together. To a point when Diane was sort of crashing on his patio and they just sort of drink in misery together at one point. But I'm very glad we're not going back to that well.
I like the way that progressed within season 1, because you had this BoJack appreciating that the first time someone did actually seem to be taking a sincere interest in him and didn't have some ulterior motive and didn't seem overtly dysfunctional as a person. We see Diane's own character flaws come out over time, but she's someone who filled this in his life that he knew he was missing and he didn't really understand. And so he acts the way that he always does, and he tries to turn that into a romantic thing and just not reading or maybe not caring that interest wasn't reciprocated. And the awkward fallout from that, I thought, was portrayed quite realistically and also quite well. And I'm glad that that was it. That was the moment where they realized we can be friends, we can understand each other in a way that other people can't. But there can't be anything between us because we both know that's not going to end well for anyone.
I think that then goes along with Diane, with the whole storyline with Diane about, like, this compatibility and recognizing who you're compatible with romantically versus, you know, who is it that you just have a deep connection with? Because I think that sometimes there is this sort of push to, when you can connect with somebody, that, like, it becomes this sort of romantic thing, or you want to make it this romantic thing. But that's not what all relationships should be. I mean, I think that within our lives, we sort of cultivate different relationships and they all serve different purposes. They don't all have to, you know, check every single box. So it's actually kind of interesting to think about Diane's relationship with BoJack in the context of then her relationship with Mr. Peanut Butter.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in that, you know, when the underground episode, you know, Diane doesn't necessarily come to Mr. Peanut Butter's side. She holds herself up with BoJack in the living room and they just, like, drink themselves silly, essentially. So you can sort of find that there are certain parts of Diane's life that she sort of goes to sort of satiate things. When she wants to be cheered up, she'll go to Mr. Peanut Butter. When she wants to wallow in misery, she'll go to, you know, BoJack. If she needs to get her ass in gear, she'll go to Princess Carolyn, who will, like, whoop it in there. So I feel like the relationships between all 5 of these characters intersect so interestingly. And I'm glad that throughout these 4 seasons, we've gotten more examples of it, because you could say in paper that, oh, it's all about BoJack's relationship to each and every character. But now that we've sort of had them work together in varying capacities, again, we talked about before fleshing out the ensemble. I'm glad that's one big example of it.
And that unconditional positivity, I think, is what draws Diane to him in the first place, because she seems quite neurotic. She has a lot of stuff going on that she has to work through in her own way, and knowing that she has someone who, regardless, is not going to question her on that, is not going to force her to confront those issues, it's comforting. And in the short term, it's a useful thing to have to comfort yourself, but it means that you're not addressing your problems head on, right? It means that when she actually needs to have a serious discussion about anything, he can't be the one that she goes to, because that's not the way he's wired. He always has this sunny, positive disposition, and he deals with his problems when he rarely confronts them by just blasting positivity at them until they go away or something changes. And that seems to work pretty well for him. So you can understand why that's his technique, but it also means that it's a relationship of comfort more than actual compatibility is what it seems to me.
Yes, that cosign. Thank you.
Because we see BoJack say I'll give the quote here. Nobody completes anybody. That's not a real thing. If you're lucky enough to find someone you can halfway tolerate, sink your nails in and don't let go, no matter what. And I don't think the show endorses that point of view. And you can see how, I think in this relation among others, how that breaks down when things actually do get tough. But is that a sustainable life philosophy to any degree?
I don't know if Ooh. Mike should answer this question.
I mean, again, the Zelda side of me would like to think so. I mean, I also came from like a very weird perspective in that, you know, my wife and I knew each other for a very, very long time before we ended up getting together. So it was essentially like adding a romantic aspect on top of our friendship. And I know that does not necessarily work for anyone, but I mean, it's tough because I also have so many like single friends in my life who enjoy what they're doing. And it's not necessarily about this idea of like, sometimes your soulmate is like your best friend or is your sister. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be a romantically affiliated relationship. So again, that might be the Mr. Peanut Butter side in me, but I would refute BoJack's claim a little bit just because, you know, I wouldn't say this is the idea of completing somebody as much as it is more complimenting than completing.
Sure. So this is sort of tangential, but I heard the Hidden Brain podcast from NPR, and it was all about marriage and relationships and about how there's sort of this want to put everything on the person that you marry. So every need that you have needs to be satisfied by the person that you marry. Whereas in reality, that may not necessarily be the case. You may look to a lot of different people in order to fulfill all your needs. And, you know, the person that you marry fulfills maybe a subset of those. But, you know, if you need to bitch about something, you maybe call your sibling or something like that. You know, you may not necessarily need to go. So anyway, so I think that sort of fits in where, you know, it's not that you necessarily need one person, but you may have sort of multiple people that fulfill a number of roles in your life.
If only Diane had a Hidden Brain ringtone, she wouldn't have so many problems, maybe.
She's got enough NPR voices on there.
I still can't believe they got them all to do it.
I know.
That's amazing.
That might be my favorite small repeated gag on the show. Just if you had to distill the essence of Diane into one character in the space of 30 seconds, have someone watch that montage of her NPR-themed ringtones, and that's all you need to see.
Oh, that's beautiful.
let's go into what we think the show says about relationships and people more broadly and how it deals with some of the darker issues that it revisits from time to time. So I'll open the floor up to whichever one of you wants to start on that.
You know what? I will say that I think BoJack Horseman teaches that people can simultaneously break you and build you up. I think that we see countless times in BoJack's life in particular that he runs into these people that absolutely destroy his credibility, destroy him as a person, etc. But then he finds these other people that are able to sort of rebuild him. And maybe it's sort of building back to this status quo as we talked about over the course of this podcast. But as we were just speaking about, this is a show that's built on relationships. And I think it's just coming to terms with the fact that not everything is sunny and rosy, but not everything is dark and stormy. As per usual, it's a mix of different weather types, but the fact of the matter is you live your life through the relationships that you make, and some of them will absolutely break you down, but some of them will absolutely make your day.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that the sort of the emphasis on relationships and sort of how your interactions with other people then end up impacting your life. Because I think, you know, when BoJack sort of runs away at the end of season three, and then he has that relationship with the fly that doesn't fly. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's something that really deeply shapes him and really impacts him. I think the emphasis on relationships, and then sort of, Mike, like you were talking about this balance between, like, life sucks, but there are good parts in life too, and those things can conflate, right? They're not completely compartmentalized like Princess Carolyn would like us to think they are. They interact with one another, and that's something that's just sort of true about life in general.
In some ways, a dangerous move to have issues be conveyed through the character of BoJack, who is so fundamentally flawed, because you could see some people taking the message away that, you know, that's what depression does to you, or like if you are dealing with those issues, this is how you're inevitably going to end up. It could be seen as like offering an excuse for his behavior, that the fact that he is going through this gives him carte blanche to act however he wants. But I think the show does a great job of setting him up as relatable in some ways, and yet as someone you absolutely do not want to relate to in others. And that tension is what keeps the show interesting, but it means that when he's the vehicle for delivering those messages, it comes across as nuanced and realistic in the way that you'd hope for.
Yeah, the nuance is there, especially, I feel like, the times when we see that he has a heart, which are rare, but, I mean, the episode that always breaks my heart is the penultimate episode from season 3, you know, That's Too Much Man, which is Sarah Lynn's sort of swan song, and you see in those final moments of her life, like, him actually embrace somebody. And, you know, they say in the next episode, I think that, you know, the way that the reason why Sarah Lynn loved BoJack so much is because he was the only person that didn't ask something of her, that didn't want her to give him something. And you see that, like, when he doesn't do that, when he's not, you know, exploiting people for certain things, he can actually care on a pretty good level. And that's why I was so excited with the way season 4 ended, where he has this conversation with Hollyhock and she says, you know, I don't need another father, but I've never had a brother. And it says so interestingly for season 5 and onward, assuming that, you know, she's going to keep being brought in as a character, because now you sort of have this relationship where he's not getting anything out of her. You know, he felt like he had to at first because he felt like he would fulfill some sort of like paternal role, mm-hmm, by default almost. But now that he sort of has a connection with her and they have some shared personality quirks and they get along fundamentally as people, again, a weird term to attribute to these horses. But I feel like those are the moments that you empathize with him the most and you make him realize that, yes, he is absolutely a callous shell of a person sometimes, but there is a heart fundamentally beating underneath that shell.
I do wonder, though, if Sarah Lynn, in that moment, she needed someone who would ask something of her, because someone who is going to let her indulge all of her worst impulses, that's only going to lead to pain for herself and for other people. Maybe it would have to be conveyed to her in a more sympathetic way than anyone who has done that in the past, where they must have some ulterior motive in mind. But BoJack, I think his flaws and hers intersect in a way which ultimately led to just this terrible outcome, and that doesn't seem like that came out of the blue. It felt like that was a long time coming.
Yeah, well, I think that the scene with Sarah Lynn when she's like first becoming famous and BoJack goes to pitch that show to her, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, and she essentially says something along the lines of like, oh, it's so hard being famous, you know, no, really famous. And then he, you know, BoJack sort of jumps into pitching the show and Sarah Lynn just needs a friend. And it's almost like that is the type of relationship. It was just some type of friendship support from early on. And I think the fact that BoJack had been mistreated by his parents, then he ends up sort of mistreating Sarah Lynn. You sort of see this perpetual behavior that leads to the self-destruction of Sarah Lynn. And BoJack, because he is sort of in that same boat, really does push that along. And oh my God, that episode just, ugh, I cry every time.
You also see these themes brought up in a way that highlights some of those common cliches that you hear without explicitly saying, oh, this is a very important episode that you're meant to pay attention to. But it just kind of incorporates it so effortlessly in a way that leaves you free to make your own judgment about them. So when Princess Carolyn says to BoJack very early on, I don't know how you expect anyone else to love you when you so clearly hate yourself. Like, that's the line that I've used on people in the past and you often see brought up. But it's something which, if you think about it, can be construed in a very damaging way, right? Because it assumes that you are the best judge of your own self-worth. And that's not a safe assumption for anyone that you would want to use that line on. But in the moment, it's not like you have this flashing neon sign saying, Princess Carolyn is wrong or Princess Carolyn is right. It just throws that out into the universe and lets you ruminate on it for a bit.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, that's where there's that whole thing built around the inane idea to make the Secretariat marketing just a big old mirror. There are times when, you know, BoJack looks at himself in that magazine and it says, you are Secretariat on top of it. And when we look out and we find out that Secretariat was also going through, which was BoJack's childhood hero, was going through his own shit, you sort of realize, I mean, I think to Liana's point, the idea of the theme of generations, especially in this most recent season, is really prevalent as well. And we get to know these characters' families and where they come from and what informs their behavior. It really starts to sort of shade in the broad lines that we get with some of these characters. And some of them are played for humor and some of them are played for definitely not humor. But I mean, if you're talking about the whole nature versus nurture, I feel like this show definitely sides on nurture, even though the nature side, I guess, comes out in the actual species they are.
Yeah, because one line the show keeps going back to, and I think does explicitly endorse, is you are what you do. Like, it's not enough to say you're a good person or to have everyone else call you a good person or treat you like you're a good person. You have to be a good person. And that might not always give you rewards. You might not always feel great about yourself in doing it. But if you want to actually be good, you have to be good. And so I think the show, in that sense, is almost an optimistic message that even if you have done terrible things in the past or you haven't always liked who you are, you can change. And the way to do that is to just start doing it. You don't have to jump through any hoops or like pass any tests or anything. That's the only step that you have to go down.
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes with the quote that you brought up earlier, Mike, that it gets easier. Every day it gets a little easier, but you got to do it every day. That's the hard part, but it does get easier. That, you know, you can have this element of improvement. But I thought I could just say thoughts and prayers and it would be okay, but apparently that's not the main message of the show.
And that baboon, you see in the flashbacks to like 2007 and earlier that he's running with someone that you assume is his wife, like his long-term partner, and then she's gone. And the show never mentions that. There's no, there's nothing directing you to it, but it's something which, when you pick it up on a rewatch, it just breaks your heart for that split second. The other line that I thought was worth bringing up was Bojack on Mr. Peanut Butter saying, "He's so stupid, he doesn't know how miserable he should be, and I envy that." Because I think it's easy to romanticize that kind of feeling and hope that, oh, well, the trade-off is that you unlock this genius that only people that that go through what you're going through have access to. So you see this a lot when people say, like, oh, well, Abraham Lincoln was depressed and all of these successful people were depressed. But it would be much easier for them if they hadn't been, and they would gladly have given all of that up in order to be happy. So I'm not quite sure what the takeaway from that is meant to be. And Bojack, who we are going to see, is not always a reliable narrator when it comes to these things. I think, again, the show doesn't say this is wrong, you shouldn't believe it, but it shows that if someone like Bojack, who is so messed up in so many ways, can think that, then that's not a healthy thought pattern, and you should think about other things, maybe.
Yeah, it's interesting how they sort of blow up the ignorance is bliss type of philosophy, because I feel like initially with Mr. Peanut Butter and Todd, they do sort of buy into that of like, look how miserable Bojack is, but look at how happy Mr. Peanut Butter and Todd are. Maybe that's the way to go. But then as they sort of slowly unravel those characters, it's much more three-dimensional than you may think. I mean, we've talked about before, I feel like it's sort of a healthy mixture of both, but, you know, everyone, I feel like, is slowly becoming a little more misanthropic, which is so interesting to watch. It almost feels like from a meta perspective, these characters are almost sort of getting tired of like being in a cartoon almost, which is sort of verbalized, but I love it that they're sort of getting tired and exhausted with these exploits and these day in and day out shenanigans that occur, that now we're starting to see some real wear and tear on some of them.
Yeah, and I think to show that, you know, they all have their own issues, even if it's not the same ones that Bojack is dealing with. You know, Mr. Peanut Butter and Todd sort of have their own things that they're dealing with, even though sometimes they may exude that positivity. But when I was in undergrad, I remember there was a study that was like, oh, well, smart people drink more. We were like, yeah. I don't know how this kind of fits, but this made me think of that. I was like, yeah. That's why we drink so much. It's because we're smart.
There's also a Bojack, I can't remember who he says it to, but he says, you're such a self-pitying masochist that if I said 10 nice things and one negative thing, you'd fixate on the one negative thing. And I think that makes us all self-pitying masochists, because I think each of us have delivered that line verbatim to Taryn at some point over the past few months or so.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's that's the thing that really I like about this show as well, is that, you know, as a content creator, some of the creative stuff and the idea of sort of, especially with Diane and Princess Carolyn, about sort of how you fit into the machine of Hollywood and trying to create your own material, which might jut up against like the common zeitgeist, is, you know, something that I deal with sometimes. But I think that, you know, dealing with the creative process is something that really ruminates with me. And to that point, it's definitely a quote that I have said many times to myself, to Taryn, to random passersby on the street. It really has become like a motto in my life.
So what other takeaways do you think the show gives you in that kind of theme then?
I mean, I think, well, you know, there are so many quotes that I think really stand out to me, a number of ones that you've touched on. But one that I always think about is, I think this is Wanda, the TV.
Lisa Kudrow. Yeah.
Yeah, Lisa Kudrow. And her quote is like something along the lines of like, when you look at someone with rose colored glasses, all the red flags just look like flags. Maybe this is, again, from my like personal experience of just dealing with a lot of like relationship shit, that is another quote of like, okay, how you interact with other people, how you see other people. But then also you can turn that and sort of flip that on yourself as well. But it almost feels like BoJack's glasses are like black, you know, whatever the opposite of rose colored is. So I think that that's one thing that always stands out to me.
Does the show give you a model of who you should be acting like instead? Because someone like Wanda is seems like a just a normal functional human being, but maybe that's only by comparison to all of the twisted people within this universe. Is there anyone who does stand out like that? Because it feels almost cheap if there is, because the takeaway from so many other parts of the show is everyone is complex. Even the people who seem like they have it all figured out or don't really care have something going on that they don't know how to deal with. And if there was just some like paragon of virtue who you could uncritically endorse, then that would take away from what the show is really trying to impart to you.
It's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I don't think so personally. I don't think there's really a role model, because I think that every character has flaws and they have, you know, good qualities as well. And that, going back to our very original plan from this podcast, is what's the most realistic about this is, yes, it is focused around a talking horse who drinks and gets drunk with like four times the amount of alcohol it would take a human to get wasted. But they have, you know, human emotions at the end of it. They might be going through shit in a weirdly absurd sense where there's so many crazy circumstances surrounding them, but the feelings are still there and they're still, and you're never going to meet the perfect person. As much as you think you might see someone who is perfect in each and every way, everybody has their flaws. And to the quote that we mentioned earlier, it's about not focusing on those flaws and instead focusing on what's good about someone and how you can cultivate a relationship around that.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to pick the most perfect character, it's obviously esteemed character actress Margot Martindale.
That's true.
No, I agree, Mike. I mean, I think that there isn't one character that is sort of an example of how you're supposed to behave, but that's what's almost good and bad, right? Because I think there's part of me that's like, well, just tell me what to do. Like, just tell me what the key to happiness is. But obviously there isn't one. And so you see these characters who are going through like horrible things and things that they're dealing with. And, you know, it doesn't give you a roadmap of how to behave, but it gives you examples and it helps you relate and it helps you work through what's going on with you, because that's the way that you have to address whatever issues are going on. And, you know, you need people to help out with that. And if this show gives examples, you know, that can help, I mean, I think that that's really where the strength comes from, not, you know, an example of how you're supposed to behave.
Find someone who looks at you the way that Todd's phone looks at Princess Carolyn's phone. And that's the key to happiness.
Yes! that's another example of like doing something creatively. I mean, that's the only time I think they've done some sort of anthology, like let's tell four different stories over the course of an episode. So, I mean, the creative ambition and emotional solidity of BoJack Horseman is something that make me really love the show and use it as a source of inspiration sometimes, just because it shows that, again, I grew up trying to essentially feel that, like, okay, you can be funny, so you don't necessarily need to focus on all the bad stuff that's going on. You can ignore that to just make people laugh. And what the show taught me is, like, you could take the comedy mask and the drama mask into your arms and hug them both equally. You know, you should embrace all of your feelings, whatever may come from that in a good way or a bad way, in order to really embrace yourself fully as a human being.
Let's end on a happier note then. If we go around listing any particular episodes or moments or quotes or anything that really hasn't been spoken about enough so far in your view.
Okay, there's one line. I think it's from episode for season four. I can't really remember. It's when they do the judge show, the booty
show. Who was it?
Felicity Huffman's Booty Academy. Yeah.
Yes,
that's
right.
What it is. Yeah.
There's this one read that's, someone better be checking the pH levels of that jacuzzi because these bitches are basic. I'm sorry, but for some reason that really stands out. It's so stupid. It's so funny. I love it. It's also some sort of scientific, so I like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's really speaking to your wheelhouse there. I mean, I'm trying to think of...
Wait, hold on. What are you calling Liana here?
I think I actually called myself a basic bitch on RuPaul's Drag Race podcast.
You did earlier, like 2 hours earlier, Leon. I did. So, like, let me check the time codes here. I mean, some of the stuff, as a big fan of wordplay, I loved all of the Courtney Portnoy stuff from season 4. And even there's a sequence in the season 4 premiere where Todd goes to ski school and he goes through the entire arc of like one of these sports movies all in 3 minutes, where he like meets a teacher who treats him badly, but it's only because he wants to build him up stronger. And then he's dying, and then he dies, and then he comes back to life as Todd wins, or as Mr. Peanut wins everything. I think that's just a lot of fun. There's this really fun tracking shot, and it's weird to say tracking shot in animation, that they do when they Todd and Mr. Peanut Butter lose the Oscars envelope, where it just tracks them following them through all these crazy landscapes that I really enjoy as well. And I just like the George Clooners. For some reason, that's just a really fun name to say.
I think also the running gag with Mr. Peanut Butter getting stuff printed on t-shirts,
yes!
and banners. Like an underlined birthday. No, don't write that. That's actually printed on the banner. That always makes me laugh.
I would submit the entirety of the game show episode Let's Find Out, which
to me,
if I had to submit one episode for any kind of award, that would be it. It's just everything about it is so absurd, from JD Salinger as like this dictator in the directing room, just announcing that I knew this show would bring us to the heights of human drama more perfectly than literature dreamed, and somehow it does in a weird way. Like, it's just everything about it, from like Bojack's essay question just coming completely out of left field, to the horrific screams that transition between the different rounds. The best part, I think, is the montage of Bojack asking the questions correctly when he's not meant to, when he and Daniel Radcliffe are in all these different costumes and positions. And you can see Daniel Radcliffe looking more and more perplexed and angry each time. It's just, and then, of course, the Elijah Wood name drop at the end to close it out. It's that, if I had to give someone just 25 minutes of TV to watch to express how I feel about the medium as a whole, that would be it, I think. It's just such a perfect episode.
And it ends with him, out of spite, burning money for charity just to spite Daniel Radcliffe. It's like textbook Bojack.
That made me thinking of Daniel Radcliffe, of when Sarah Lynn is dating Andrew Garfield.
Oh, yes.
Like, Andrew Garfield likes lasagna and hates Mondays.
And of course, his exaggerated British accent, like, a Bojack podcast? How fiendishly droll. Which is, that's how I plan to talk from now on. That's my new aesthetic.
I love it.
Oh yeah, there's so many good things. I mean, even talking about this makes me want to rewatch the series if I ever have time. Yes, it will be a spiral into depression, but there's so much great stuff. And you're actually like, I think I like the chickens one, just because even though it's so goofy with the chicken, I like the fact that all she says is bok bok, and for some reason they'll interpret it to mean different things. Like, her favorite band is Beck. Her name is Becca.
Yeah, because she's going to book Beck.
Book Beck, yeah.
That episode's so stupid. I love it.
Well, before this spirals back down into something horribly dark, let's all get out of here. So where can people find you, and should they, I suppose?
I don't know. I don't know if you want to after this. So I am on social media at Liana Boris, LianaBoras, and doing some really fun things over on RHAP, doing updates for Big Brother Canada on Saturdays, as well as the RHAP B&B with Mike Bloom. And apparently I can't shake him, because we also do the RuPaul's Drag Race podcast, covering season 10 right now, which has been so much fun so far.
I didn't say you could plug anything, but apparently that's what we're doing now. So Mike, anything that you've got?
All right, here we go.
You might as well just go to sleep, just take a nap.
You can follow me at a Mike Bloom type. I to your point that you made at the very beginning of this podcast, somebody actually did call me out, like, are you like a Ryan Seacrest type? Which I did. I think I made it like several years before BoJack premiered, but now I definitely can't take it, because I love the appearance of a Ryan Seacrest type. It's just it's such a fantastic recurring.
I assumed that was the inspiration and that you changed it to that, but I didn't want to ask in case it ruined the joke. So you're blowing my mind here, Mike.
Yeah, well, I'm some lady.
Yeah, exactly. So Liana mentioned the B&B and Drag Race recaps. I also do SNL recaps on a podcast called SNL Funhouse with Mario Lanza, which is a lot of fun. Mario and I will be getting together with Jay and Paul to also cover the Survivor Historians. We'll be getting back to Samoa at some point while we've been spending so much time in Fiji. I have a movie podcast called The Hamster Factor with AJ Mass. I stream D&D every other week on a program called The Campaign on TPK Games on Twitch. So yeah, a lot of irons in the fire, but I'm so happy to take a brief dalliance from reality TV to talk about the reality that comes with this TV. So this has been so much fun to get to talk about two cartoons that I absolutely love to death with you, Dom.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun and also morbidly depressing, but those, as we see in BoJack, those two can coexist. If you want to find me, I'm at DomHRV. If you want to find a future Hard Jeopardy question, Colin Stone, he can be found at Colin Stone. And we will have lots of episodes about various other shows coming to you very soon. But in the meantime, I think that will do it. Thank you once again, Mike and Liana, for joining me, and we will talk to all of you again soon.